From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Midtown, San Jose.
19th Avenue, San Francisco.
San Mateo.
Sunnyvale.
Excelsior District of San Francisco.
Financial District.
Today we'll end our series on the state's most secretive prisons with a visit to the one cell block no reporter had ever seen before.
You are correct. We do have a Mr. Charles Manson.
That's at Corcoran State Prison. Then we'll hear from an inmate at the California Men's Colony. He'll be paroled in just a few weeks.
Believe me, I would like to discuss my housing options with someone before I'm dropped onto the street with $200 in my name.
And we'll hear from you about what you thought of our recent profile of San Francisco Sheriff Ross Mercurimi.
Without a doubt, he screwed up royally, but I don't think it rose to the level of him losing his job.
We're going behind the scenes today on Cross Currents. Today we'll hear the final installment in our series on press access to the most restricted areas within the state's prisons. KALW's Nancy Mullane takes us with her into the one cell block no reporter had ever visited before, according to the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. It's called the Protective Housing Unit, or the PHU. It's at Corcoran State Prison in California's Central Valley. And its unique purpose isn't to protect the public from the most dangerous inmates. It's where the state houses inmates who need protection from everyone else. KALW's Nancy Mullane reports.
It's early, about 5 in the morning. I'm heading south on Highway 5 toward Corcoran, a farming town of about 24,000. Though that population count is misleading. Half of the people there are locked up in two of the state's largest prisons just south of downtown. It's not the 12,000 prisoners I'm driving 5 hours each way to report on. It's one small pod of cells embedded deep inside Corcoran State Prison, a unit that's so secret, I've been told by press officers inside the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, no reporter has ever been permitted to go inside. In fact, even they don't know the names of the 2 dozen inmates who live there.
Alrighty.
At 10 in the morning, I arrive. I meet Teresa Cisneros in her office.
I'm the public information officer. I'm the only one that speaks to the media, so I will be able to respond to any of the questions you have.
So no one else can tell me anything about Corcoran but you?
But me, correct.
Okay.
I ask her to explain why the Protective Housing Unit is so secretive. She pulls out a binder, flips open to a page, and begins to read.
PHU stands for Protective Housing Unit, and this is for inmates whose safety would be in danger by general population placement, meaning they can be placed with other
inmates. Cisneros tells me that means inmates with verified enemies, inmates who are infamous, have committed an especially egregious crime, or have received unusual media attention. Inmates in the PHU also can have serious medical or mental health issues, so they won't pose a threat to the other infamous inmates locked up there.
We don't need other inmates that may have an agenda on them to let them know that this is where this inmate is housed. So that's why we protect their identity and actual information on where they're housed and how many are in there.
Even though the names of the inmates in the PHU are protected, when I ask, Cisneros confirms.
You are correct. We do have a Mr. Charles Manson. Sirhan Sirhan is no longer in the Protective Housing Unit. He's now transferred to another institution. There are other inmates that are in there, and the one that I could think of right now, if you can just hold a second, I got to get my list.
Sure. She reaches down and opens an unlocked drawer.
Is that a list of everyone in the facility?
Everyone in the housing unit, in the protective housing
unit.
Oh,
okay.
One of the ones that we just received recently was inmate Gardner.
Inmate John Gardner. Anyone living in San Diego County in 2010 knew his name. For months, he was front page news. Gardner, then 31 years old, pled guilty to the murder and rape of 17-year-old Chelsea King and 14-year-old Amber Dubois. That was in exchange for an agreement by prosecutors in San Diego County not to seek the death penalty. These were the crimes that led to Assembly Bill 1844, commonly known as Chelsea's Law, which put severe restrictions on registered sex offenders, including life sentences without the possibility of parole, for certain crimes. As part of the media coverage that surrounded Gardner's trial, he was sentenced to 2 terms of life in prison without the possibility of parole, 1 term of 25 years to life, and an additional 24 years in prison.
And that's the thing with protective housing units. The inmates that are placed in there may have stirred up a lot of media frenzy, a lot of interest.
And then there's the fame of inmates like Charles Manson.
Mr. Manson is a national concern. A lot of people know about him statewide and across other countries. But there are inmates like Mr. Gardner who may be famous or high notoriety to the community center that he came from.
We leave Cisneros' office and walk in the heat to our car. To get to the PHU, we'll have to drive all the way around to the far side of the prison. Cisneros drives around the perimeter of the prison, past chunks of gray cement cell blocks with narrow slits for windows, to a small single-story building.
We have 2 facilities. We have 4A and 4B. PHU is within facility 4A.
Each housing unit or facility in this area of the prison, Cisneros says, is self-contained, with its own laundry, chapel, canteen, and medical services.
The way you can think about it is it's a city within, so any needs that they have, they're all provided there.
We enter the small, single-story building and approach an officer, then pass through a metal detector to another door on the far side. A guard in a tower remotely opens the first side of a gated sally port. We walk into a security cage of sorts. Spools of razor wire circle around the top. Security cameras point down on the walkway. The gate we just walked through shuts behind us. Then another in front of us opens. Cisneros leads me through one security checkpoint after another. We're getting closer to the PHU, but we're not there yet.
We can't take any photos of this area that we come inside, okay?
On the other side of yet another steel gate is a massive dusty field surrounded by more gray cell blocks. Stretched out across the wide field in front of us are row upon row of back-to-back chain-link cages. Inside each cage that looks about 10 feet across, solitary prisoners wearing white boxer shorts and a T-shirt sit or stand in the already hot sun. Cisneros says these inmates are from the security housing unit. They're being isolated from the general prison population because they're perceived as dangerous to other inmates or to the public. This time, this cage time, is their yard time.
Here we are on facility 4A SHU. Don't have to take pictures of the cages. You basically won't be able to take photos of much else other than actual area in the cage.
So if I go like over there, can I shoot that way?
No, you can shoot once we get over to the SHU site, to the
actual. Oh, we're not
PHU.
In?
No.
Oh, okay. So this is
turning right, we walk down a long road away from the cages on the field and approach another 2-story gray cement block building. As we get closer, I see 4A stenciled on the building in large block type. It's the protective housing unit. We've finally made it.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. We're hearing Nancy Mullane's report on the protective housing unit at Corcoran State Prison, where inmates who need protection from other inmates are housed, including prisoners like Charles Manson. Join Nancy now as she joins prison public information officer Teresa Cisneros and enters the protective housing unit itself.
This is the PHU recreational yard.
Is it really?
In front of the cell block, we walk past a fenced-in park with thick green grass, fixed picnic tables, and a basketball court.
So this is where they come out. They had come out through several times of the day. They get to exercise, play basketball, exercise with the boxing bags, punching bags.
Unlike inmates in the security housing unit who are classified as dangerous, the inmates in the PHU are allowed to socialize and exercise together on this exclusive yard. Looking through the gaps in the chain-link fence surrounding the PHU yard just beyond the basketball court, I see the inmates have painted a huge mural of an eagle flying over an ocean, its talons reaching out, its wings American flags, and the words,
"Remember 9/11?
Yep, never forget."
But that's so interesting. And the eagle is like
beautiful.
A protector. Like, it's a flag. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a flag.
Yep.
I look down at the edge of the grass. The inmates are growing watermelons, herbs, and cherry tomatoes on vines attached to the fencing. Leaving the yard, we walk toward a blue door and the entrance to the protective housing unit. Cisneros motions to a guard looking down from a window above, and the door is opened remotely.
Kind of fascinating. I just want to take a picture. Can I take like,
you have
if
a
I
mental picture
you?
Right now.
Because to show this is so fascinating.
It's cool behind the thick cement walls.
So in this housing unit, we have the A section, B section, and C section. B and C are regular SHU units. A is the only PHU in it.
Okay.
So we'll go in there.
Okay.
And you can go ahead and...
Wow, this is an interesting... Can I take a picture of those helmets?
Sure.
Okay.
Just above our heads on a wall, riot helmets hang on hooks. And on another wall, the words, "Warning, no warning shots," are stenciled in black. While we wait for the officers to open the PHU, we stand outside and look through a narrow security window in the door. A few men in white and gray boxer shorts, T-shirts, and prison blue button-down shirts stand together outside one of the cells talking. An older inmate sits near them in a wheelchair. These are some of the most notorious convicts in California, and yet looking at them for the first time, they look comfortable with one another, like friends or buddies who hang out together and talk about the usual stuff. They look back at me through the window. Now they really have something to talk about.
This is what's considered their day room. So they get to be inside their cells. They can come out of their cells and sit on the tables here and congregate with the other inmates, watch TV. They have more freedom than the other ones, as we just saw. They have a bigger yard where they go and they have the recreational.
Cisneros reminds me these men aren't in the PHU because they're considered a discipline problem in prison. They're in the PHU because they need protection, and so they have the opportunity to socialize. Looking back through the window, I count. There are 20 cells in the protective housing unit, 10 on the first floor and 10 on the second.
So you can see the number. So let's start from 1 through 20. Each cell can house two inmates. So there could be up to two inmates per cell. And this is their life.
So they just talk to each other. They kind of just hang out. And
they live together. This is their life. This is their home. This is their house, I guess you can say, a house where they sleep, eat, work. They go out to the yard out here. They spend some time in the day room. They watch TV.
Where's the television?
It'll be inside. It's just
so do they have individual televisions in
their cells? They also have individual televisions.
And they also have radios?
Yes.
And they have the little slotted windows.
To the back.
But they have solid doors.
Yes.
So there's no slot for food. So in order for them, there is a slot?
There is a slot for food.
Oh,
where
I see
locks.
It. I see it.
However, they come out to the day room and eat out here. So during the evening meal or the breakfast meal, the food will be brought over from the kitchens, and then they will set it up. Normally, they set it up like so, and they have the steam table, and then they eat.
Some of the men in the PHU are serving a determinate sentence. That means they have already been given a date for their release. Others, like Charles Manson, are serving indeterminate sentences, meaning they will have to be found suitable for parole by a board before they'll be released. Last year, Manson was denied parole for the 12th time. Now he'll have to wait until 2027, when he'll be 92 years old, before he can ask for parole again. Above where we're standing, just outside the door to the protective housing unit, a guard motions to Cisneros.
But, now that all of the sections are secured, we can go in there. However, I would really not want the recorder on because some of the inmates say something that they shouldn't say.
How about if we do it and if anybody says anything, I can delete it.
I'm not allowed to do that.
Okay.
I turn off my deck and try to negotiate with Cisneros to allow me to turn my recorder back on before entering the unit. She agrees, but only if she can order me not to use anything recorded while we're inside the unit. With terms set, I turn my recorder back on.
You don't have to do this, do you?
The thick steel door to the PHU rolls to the side. We enter the wide-open day room and the roaring sound of a large industrial fan. A few round steel tables with fixed stools are bolted to the cement floor in the middle of the room. Over to our left are some wheelchairs parked. Toward the back of the cavernous room are two stories of cells. Cisneros tells me each cell can be opened and closed remotely.
Gecko, grab one of the empty cells in A section. I'm going to check it out.
As we walk to the front of one cell in the rusty red steel door, the inmates I saw through the window stand together and watch as we enter the cell just a few feet away.
It's a concrete cell with, you know, a sink, a toilet, a shelf. You have two concrete beds with storage areas underneath. You have a stand, shelving. You have a window to the back of the cell. You have a lighting fixture on the ceiling. That's what you have. What's this?
I point to a hole in the wall.
It's for the plugging of the appliances, like the TV or the radio. They'll have to go into inside the electrical room in there.
Oh, so they don't have a plug.
They don't have a plug, no.
So the inmates can't get direct access to the electricity. I ask Cisneros if the guards can close the cell door so I can see what it's like to be inside when the door is locked, the way it must feel for the inmates when they're inside alone.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. We're hearing Nancy Mullane's report on the protective housing unit at Corcoran State Prison, where inmates who need protection from other inmates are housed, including prisoners like Charles Manson. Join Nancy and Public Information Officer Teresa Cisneros inside one of the cells.
Cisneros motions for the guard to close the door.
She wants to be in here.
Have you ever been inside a cell before?
Locked? Yes.
Really have.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, not locked, but... yes.
Okay.
The cell door slides open. Cisneros says inmates can leave their cells at different times throughout the day to go to the day room, take a shower, watch television, or go outside the unit to the PHU's exclusive yard. Some of the inmates in the PHU are paid a few cents an hour, Cisneros says, to mop, sweep, and set up the dinner that's provided to the unit by the prison kitchen. We walk a few feet along the first tier. About midway along the cells, I peek into the unit's two central showers. The stalls are narrow, with barely enough room to turn around. Just beyond the showers, we approach the inmates standing outside the cells. They're curious. Cisneros says she's going to take me inside another cell, one of the inmates' rooms, though he's not there right now.
Whose cell is this?
One of the inmates.
While we walk around inside the 6x8-foot cell, one of the inmates standing outside the cell door watches and begins to make comments, first on a guitar hanging on a hook on the wall.
Yeah, there's five guitars in here. Yeah, it's five. They're personally owned.
Then he says what he wasn't supposed to say.
This is John Gardner's cell in San Diego.
Immediately, I put my hand over the microphone. Even though it seems like the inmate in the protective housing unit is just trying to help, I don't want to take a chance. He might disclose any confidential information.
Okay, this cell is occupied, obviously, so there is a mattress with sheets, a pillow, with pillowcases, articles of clothing, looks like maybe music CDs or cassettes. They have a guitar on the wall, fan, television, they have various canteen items, bottles of drinks, food, books, condiments. They have a box of stored goods, food items, boxing glove, glasses, various shoes, clothing, hygiene products. It's a typical apartment, you know, filled with items the inmate needs to have while they live. Pictures on the walls. Basic living necessary items.
There are boxes of macaroni dinners and packages of quick cook rice, jalapeno cheese whiz, and file folders. On the wall, religious postcards, pictures of nature, a waterfall and a beach, and a poster. Good morning, this is God. I'll be handling all of your problems today. I will not need your help, so have a great day. Beneath the cement pad and the cotton mattress that serves as his bed are box-sized cubicles where the inmate has organized dirty and clean clothes. The back window to his cell has been covered.
He's covered up the natural light. That's interesting. So he just has overhead light.
We requested they remove it during our security checks. Sometimes they will darken the light and then the back window, so it's hard for us to see. So we requested the light fixtures open so we can see, and then the back window is cleared as well.
Makes sense. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And there's a vent. What are these vents to?
It's for they can get ventilation.
Oh, that's how they get the air?
Mm-hmm.
Back outside the cell, I notice the cell next door is completely dark. The window is covered. The lights are turned off.
So this person has everything kind of blocked off. Is that okay?
Well, no, because we can still have a visual here. We can look. And so when this is an individual like this, we will have to, we need to do a security check on him. We will ask him to turn on the light and remove the back coverings.
We move back toward the center of the unit's day room. Cisneros says we aren't going to go up the stairs to the second floor. But I look up and see the faces of inmates peering out of their cell windows. As we walk back toward the entrance to the protective housing unit, one of the inmates approaches and tries to talk, asking where I'm from. But I'm ushered out of the unit, the door sliding shut behind us. Back at the prison's administration building, Cisneros asked Lieutenant Robert Whitford of the Investigative Services Unit to review the photographs I took while inside the PHU.
There's a few things I look for, and one, I look at the overall photo to see if there's anything that could jeopardize the security of the institution. For example, I looked at, you took several pictures of outside the institution, you know, entering, how you progressed to the facility. You know, did that give an overall layout that somebody could use inappropriately as possibly an escape plan or a way to illegally enter our secured perimeter? So I look for things like that. Also in the photos, I look to see, because of it being the protective housing unit, and it's exactly for the purpose of what we call it, we're there to protect those inmates. So was there anything that was revealed in the photo that could jeopardize their safety? Which I didn't see anything in your photos that I saw that would jeopardize their security or safety.
What could that, maybe that could have been a face or identifying information inside a cell or something like that?
Absolutely. And sometimes just releasing their identity or a photo of them, identifying them being housed in that unit, jeopardized their safety and possibly their family member's safety.
You know, this is the first time a member of the press has been inside the PHU in California, inside Corcoran. Do you have concerns about that? I mean, does that make you uncomfortable that somebody was in there from the press? Or do you think that based on what you've seen in my photographs and the fact that I was with Teresa Cisneros the entire time, does that give you confidence that this went all right?
As long as we have the ability to review the information that's been presented, the information you obtained, such as your photos, and make sure there's no content that could jeopardize the security of the institution, that unit, the inmates that are housed there, and you probably realized how highly we control just your visit. I think within those guidelines, I don't see an issue as long as we follow all the guidelines.
Lieutenant Whitford hands my camera back to me and leaves the room. A few moments later, Cisneros walks me to the front of the administration building. It's 1 p.m. and over 100 degrees as I start the 5-hour drive across the Central Valley back to the Bay Area. As I drive, I think back over all of the restricted prisons I've had exclusive press access to over the past year. Even though the protective housing unit is the most secretive, most restricted cell block in all of California's prison system, the place Charles Manson has been sent to live out the rest of his life, it isn't so bad. He has access to a yard with a basketball court and watermelons, and that's a whole lot better than the thousands of inmates locked up in Corcoran's security housing unit, where a 10-foot square cage is their only time in the sun. I drive on. Even though I've been given access to the most restricted cell blocks in the state, there's no guarantee any reporter will ever be let back in again. For Cross Currents, I'm Nancy Mullane.
You can find all of Nancy's work on press access at our website. It's kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. And now we'll hear from someone inside of California's prison system who's trying to get out. Inmate Richard Gilliam regularly writes to us from inside of the California Men's Colony at San Luis Obispo. For obvious reasons, we can't record Gilliam, so KLW's Chris Hoff is going to read us his letter.
As a prisoner, I am often reminded that the CDCR requires me to follow its rules. That's understandable. Rules and regulations ensure the operations run safely and smoothly. When an inmate can't or won't follow the rules, negative consequences are triggered to urge him or her to do so in the future. But what happens when the CDCR doesn't follow its own rules? Where are the negative consequences for them? Apparently, there are none. But there are negative consequences to inmates and to the community when the Department of Corrections can't follow its own rules. Let me explain. As of March 1st, I will have 38 days remaining to serve until my parole date, yet I have not signed my parole conditions, nor do I know the parole office I am to report to, and, most importantly, I have no idea where I'll be staying once I re-enter the community. This is a huge concern to me. I want as smooth a transition into the community as possible, and I want to succeed. This should be a concern to the general public as well. The community I return to shouldn't have to wonder if parolees re-entering their environs have a stable release plan, and will be accountable. The Department of Corrections Operations Manual's section on release procedures and conditions of parole articulates procedures regarding imminent paroles. Among those regulations, it says, CDC policy requires referrals to be forwarded to the regional reentry coordinator 210 days prior to the earliest possible release date. My release date has been the same for more than a year, so this notification should already have happened as of October of last year. After this notification, a parole agent is assigned. He or she is supposed to investigate any proposed residence program to determine if it is suitable for the parolee to live in. The parole agent is also required to investigate any employment, training, or school plans to determine the validity of any job offer, whether it's appropriate, and so on and so forth. If there is not enough information available for the parole agent to make an adequate assessment, he is supposed to contact the inmate to request information about alternative residence or employment plans if the proposed program is unsatisfactory. Since I gave no prospective residence or employment information when asked, the assigned parole agent, by regulation, should have contacted me by now. He or she has not. Nor have I ever heard of anyone being contacted about residential or employment plans prior to release. I'm sure I'm not the first parolee not to have a prearranged residence and job. Believe me, I would like to discuss my housing options with someone before I'm dropped onto the street with $200 in my name, less the cost of a bus ticket to Los Angeles County. I've done my part. I've researched transitional housing options and educational opportunities. But without any assistance or recognition from parole representatives, I have no idea if these resources are available. With this deliberate indifference to my and every other parolee's plight, is it any wonder why the recidivism rate among California's parolees is so high? While in prison we know we have a bed to sleep on and where our next meal is coming from, without support and acknowledgement from parole agents and their supervisors, we re-enter society unsure of our prospects and fearful of failure. But one thing we do know. If we commit another crime, there will be a bed and food waiting for us. Is this any way to promote public safety? By sending the message that the Department of Corrections, by its inaction, wants its former residents to come back, they are compromising public safety. Who suffers the negative consequences for that?
Richard Gilliam is an inmate at the California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo. His letter was read by Chris Hoff. And now we'll turn to the other side of law enforcement, the state's sworn officers. We recently aired a profile of embattled San Francisco Sheriff Ross Mercurimi.
And in my lowest point, which were many, a lot of people in the city would either come knocking on my door, because after a while everybody knew where we live, you know, or just kind of find me and said, you got to fight, you know, it's not for yourself or just your family, but it's for us too. We want you to be in that office, you know, and grow. And I appreciated that. I'll never forget it.
We heard from quite a few of you about that story. Here's some of what you had to say.
Hi, my name is Jim Wilson.
My name is Joya Corey.
This is Calvin Clark. I think that without a doubt, he screwed up royally, but I don't think it rose to the level of him losing his job.
The first thing I want to say is I don't feel grabbing your wife's arm when she's trying to get out of the car and you're having a fight rises to the level of domestic violence. I'm a feminist and very sensitive to the idea of domestic violence, but have a long marriage in which there's been screaming fights and grabbing each other's arms, and it doesn't necessarily escalate behind further than that.
I'm glad he was reinstated, and hopefully he's learned his lesson and will continue to do a good job.
My problem is that there was no extensive discussion about Eliana Lopez, I guess, and it's so important to know if there was a systematic pattern of abuse happening. I would have liked a little more reporting on, have they had counseling, what do the social workers say, was this a moment of craziness or an hour of craziness, or was it a systematic pattern?
There's a lot to talk about in our criminal justice system, and we want to know what you have to say. Give us a call at 415-264-7106 and just leave us a message. That number again is 415-264-7106, and we'll try to share your comments on the air. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Nina Gensler-Debs, Erica Mu, Laura Sapanara, Eva Sonsan, Judy Silber, Raisu Sussman, Stephen Short, Brooke Welty, and Mary Willis. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to City CarShare for providing an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City CarShare is online at citycarshare.org. Also thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. The band Journey has a special place in the hearts of many Bay Area music fans. They're on tour this month in Australia. If that's a bit far for you, you can hear the band Evolution instead. Evolution has been voted top tribute band in California twice and has the approval of the original band members. This is not a dress-up act. They're devoted to accurately recreating the music of Journey. They'll be performing Saturday at George's Nightclub in San Rafael starting about 9:30 p.m. Don't stop believing. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.